Are Jacksonville's public parks unsafe? New questions after a young boy drowns. A new poll shows a tight race between Bill Nelson and Rick Scott. And former Mayor Alvin Brown may be eyeing a run for Congress himself. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9. Also, make sure to catch our podcast on iTunes and through the WJCT app. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday Roundtable. You can get on the line now and join the conversation, 549-2937. Then later, local authors win glowing reviews for their new young adult fantasy series. We'll tell you about the Adventurers Guild. Plus, just in time for Halloween, the Rocky Horror Picture Show comes to town. Have you ever gone? We'll tell you where you can see it this weekend. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly roundtable as we welcome WJCT contributor Charles Griggs back to Studio 5. Good morning.
Good morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Hi.
And our own business analyst, John Burr, back from up in New England for the summer.
Yes.
Just in time. Your timing is everything, and I think yours is just about perfect.
Yeah, you brought the weather with me.
You brought the good weather with you, John. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And lots to discuss this week, a very busy news week, but our top story this Friday, Jacksonville's park system, the largest in the U.S., but growing questions about how those parks are maintained. Mayor Curry says he wants answers after the body of 3-year-old Amari Harley was discovered in a park water tank Sunday. Now, Amari first went missing at a birthday party at Arlington's Bruce Park, and he was found dead several hours later in a water tank, which is part of the sewage system used for the park's restrooms. As the city investigation gets underway, watchdogs around town this week have been quick to point out, in the wake of Amari's death, that there is actually neglected infrastructure all over the city of Jacksonville that could lead to another tragedy, both in our parks and in spots around town. So as we look at this top story, here's our question to callers. What do you think about the maintenance of our public parks, the largest urban park system in these United States? Should the city more adequately fund those parks? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can also weigh in on Facebook. And the mayor's office saying the other day that in the wake of this tragedy, the city is now going to change its procedure and standardize its process for lids covering underground sewage tanks at all city parks, a sweeping assessment after 3-year-old Amari Harley was found dead Sunday in this tank. Apparently, Bruce Park is among 76 city parks that have septic systems or lift stations for restrooms, as we're learning. Charles Griggs, we've known for years that, you know, we have all these pocket parks, big parks, little parks, a patchwork of parks all over Duval County. Some are better maintained than others, clearly.
Yeah, so, but first, you know, we know our hearts go out to the family of Amari.
Yeah.
And this is probably one of the most tragic incidents we've seen across this city in a long time. This is a very tragic situation. And the answer to the question would be yes. I think taxpayers and residents would want to see more spent on infrastructure regarding parks. Everybody wants to have a robust park system, knowing that it has accessibility and they are safe. However, you know, that would be up to the will of the people and taxpayers to make sure that happens. They have to send a clear message to their policymakers and their stakeholders that this is what we want and be prepared to deal with what it takes to make that happen.
It's 549-2937 to join our Friday roundtable. You know, A.G. Gankarski, for many mayoral administrations, I can remember different leadership teams giving lip service to our park system, but I don't really ever remember the dollars being in place to go from the biggest park system in the country to the best.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, when Council President Brochet took over that role earlier this year, she talked about how Jacksonville's park system was one of the most neglected in the entire country. I think it was 92 in a list of 100. And parks always take, they don't take primary consideration. I mean, you look at roads, you look at potholes, you look at things like the electrical grid. These things are things that jump out at us. We don't really think about parks in terms of infrastructure until something like this happens, which is a real anomaly, which is something the city is still looking into how it happened. And that's another question also. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what the mayor's plan is for putting capital in parks, but it will come at the expense of something else. And the question is what's going to be deprioritized? Is it going to be septic tank remediation? Is it going to be the Hart Bridge project? Is it going to be something else? Are we going to bond the money out? I mean, you've got these questions. So right now, we're really at a conceptual phase of this, and we'll see what kind of follow through there is from both the council and the mayor's office.
That's right. John Burr, in an era when there are limited dollars to spend, something else the city is looking at is spending about $1 million to study taking down the ramps that lead off the Hart Bridge into downtown Jacksonville. These overland ramps that that barrel past Everbank Field and kind of let out into downtown. That's right. Another big infrastructure project.
It is. But I'll get to that in a second. Let me talk about the parks a little bit. You know, the parks, people love the parks. So it's really kind of a mystery. It's an easy political thing to spend money on parks because people really appreciate their parks and they want better parks. But it's more than money. You know, there must be some sort of bad culture in the Parks Department. I mean, they had a complaint in January that this very sewage lid was not working, was open. And, you know, here we are in end of October and nothing's been done. And this poor boy drowns in the tank. Well, you know, it doesn't take, that's an attitude. That betrays an attitude within the Parks Department of, hey, you know, well, whatever, you know. And that's more than that speaks to more than money. Now, in terms of the overland expressway, well, you know, we're getting all kinds of ideas on why this thing should be torn down. You know how these projects are funded? There's a matrix, and the more boxes you can check on a state matrix as to why a project is a good project, the better chances it's going to be done. So, you know, now it started with safety and then, you know, something else. And economic development was the second reason. Now the port, transportation to the port is the third reason why it should be torn down. Well, you know, it's really all about Shad Khan's project. And, you know, but you can't just check the matrix box with one box. You got to find more boxes to check. So that's what this exercise is about.
I want to go back to what John mentioned earlier about access to parks. Many people will recall that Better Jacksonville had a preservation project underneath it, which the city had set aside funding to purchase park space and then make it accessible to the public. And, you know, one of the challenges even back then was additional funding that was going to be coming down the pipe for maintaining those parks. And you might want to wonder right now if in fact, that's having an impact with, you know, we created the largest park system in the country with building access, which is a good thing. But being able to maintain all of that is something that, you know, certainly now, and unfortunately it takes a tragedy to do that, but certainly now that you can take a cold, hard look at how we can make sure that we adequately be able to do that. I think that the city said that they fixed that, you know, a few times, that lid a few times, but, you know, it will still seem that that there will be some opportunity to maybe improve the way that process is handled.
Yeah, all it takes is one malefactor to come and unscrew the lid. I mean, it's a screwdriver. So, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I know the people in council, they've got a special parks committee. Things they've been talking about are like security cameras in the parks, which if you had a malefactor who was going and loosening that lid for whatever, a security camera would have caught that. You know, security measures, you know, obviously fences around these septic holes would be good practice. It's just something where, you know, when we look at these projects, we have to consider, you know, how much we're going to put into this because, you know, like I said, it's going to come at the expense of something else. It's going to be at the expense of some other priority. And, you know, I'm not expecting some holistic, you know, $20 million project to redo the park system. There's just too many other things going on. What will happen is you'll see the safety motivated fixes, and you know, then this will go out of the headlines until the next time something like this
happens.
Well,
maintenance is a big issue from, you know, not just you think in terms of lids for covers, but you still have things like benches and
even going beyond the parks, as I pointed out a minute ago, in the wake of this little boy's death, people are pointing out there are glaring infrastructure issues, safety issues all over the city outside our park system.
Yeah, Sam Moussa said the city could handle a $400 million capital improvement budget.
Right.
This year's $131 million, and that's with the pension savings, that's with the favorable financing, low interest rates, all of that. So, you know, $131 is probably the high water mark. So any infrastructural fixes will be dependent on 10 years of a really good economy and nothing bad happening. I mean, so, you know, the infrastructure issues are going to take years, if not decades, resolve, and, you know, honestly, they may never be resolved.
And, you know, we have really glaring infrastructure issues, but of course, there are cities that have even bigger, deeper, more hideously awful infrastructure issues than Jacksonville. I mean, fly into LaGuardia, New York, and then come back and talk about infrastructure. You know what I'm saying? Like, it could always be worse.
You can fly in, but you can't fly out.
I know.
Yeah, but I mean, compare us to Orlando and Tampa and places like that, places that had higher millage rates over decades.
Yes.
They don't have the same issues.
Yes, our millage rate is at the nub of all of this.
And
absolutely right.
And Jacksonville's fixed cost ratio, according to an article in Bloomberg today, is among the highest of major cities. Mm. And that is entirely attributed to pension debt. So we've got like such a high fixed cost ratio, it limits what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically like all your
credit
cards.
As long as there is no political will to wiggle that millage
and yet, that infrastructure fund, emergency fund, they're trying to get the ramp to the Hart Bridge funded under that. And that, I'm sorry, that's not an infrastructure.
But we're going to spend
emergency.
$1 million just to study it first. We're going to drop $1.5 million just to study it.
I know. And I always make the offer, I can do it for $750,000. But nobody's taking me up
sure
on it.
I'm pretty sure AG would turn in a report for less than that.
Oh, you'd be surprised what $750,000 could get from me. But.
All right. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. Charles Griggs, AG Gankarski, John Burr, myself, talking about the biggest stories of the week. Give us a call with your thoughts, 549-2937. Also making headlines this week, a new poll from UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab shows a tight race between Florida Governor Rick Scott and incumbent Senator Bill Nelson. Scott, who is term limited as governor, is widely expected in his next political move to challenge Nelson for his Senate seat. And it looks like a dead heat, according to the UNF poll. So here's our question to callers. Who will get your vote for Senate in 2018? Rick Scott or Bill Nelson? Give us a call, 549-2937. Not surprisingly, registered Democrats polled say Nelson will get their vote at 66%. 68% of Florida's registered Republicans will vote for Scott. Job approval ratings show Scott outpacing Nelson significantly, but at the same time, President Trump has strong disapproval ratings overall, but high approval ratings in Florida among Republicans. So I guess the Trump factor will play at least some role in this race.
Well,
Charles Griggs.
This is, you know, Florida is a red state until it's not. And Governor Scott has been campaigning for the last 3 years. I mean, of his, you know, the last portion of his term, the second term, he's been campaigning. So it's not like Senator Nelson is going to be running against someone who's a novice or someone who has name recognition. This is why the poll looks like it looks now. And until we get into a situation where there's an actual campaign at hand, then the numbers are going to look like this.
You know, here's the thing with it. It's that poll had 49% of respondents had no opinion of Bill Nelson. And that's got to be your Drudge Alert, you know, Drudge Report red siren, because if you've been in there for a few terms and 50% of voters don't know anything about you, that means you can be defined by external factors such as Rick Scott's political committee. They put $2 million into ad buys already, and the $2 million is going to positive things like hurricanes and, you know, things that Rick Scott has done that people generally approve of. You know, but that that money's going to be spent negatively eventually. And when it is, it's going to define Rick Nelson basic, or Bill Nelson as basically Bernie
Ricky
Sanders.
Ricky Nelson. Now we're going into the Wayback Pile.
Yeah, I'm wish. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be something where Bill Nelson's going to be linked with Bernie Sanders, going to be linked with Obamacare, linked with everything that, you know, the swing voter and, you know, the right wing voter can say, we don't want this guy here. It's going to energize the base. It's an off year election, which is also trouble for Democrats. Bill Nelson is in serious trouble.
Yeah, I agree. And to Charles's point, where we aren't even anywhere close to a campaign yet, back in February, UNF did this poll, and Nelson was ahead, up by 6 points on Scott. So, you know, still, we're still in the preliminary phases, and Nelson's losing ground. So it's very bad news for Nelson.
Interesting. And let's talk about another Politico whose name you all remember, eyeing a run at Washington as well. And the number to join us, everyone is hanging on your every word because they'd rather listen than call.
They're pre-gaming for Florida, Georgia.
It's quite amazing. They must all be out there partying in the RV city outside our building. It's 549-2937.
Oh, yeah. At 9 o'clock in the morning?
Actually, yes. Surprisingly enough, I have seen that.
Radio, I'm sure.
549-2937. Give us a call here on the Friday Roundtable. And another Politico whose name you all remember is eyeing a run at Washington as well. Former Jacksonville Mayor Alvin Brown told a crowd of Democrats Wednesday evening to look for a big announcement from him soon. Brown looks to be returning to the political world. He is widely expected to challenge Congressman Al Lawson, the Tallahassee Democrat who ousted Corrine Brown last year and who currently represents both parts of this city, Jacksonville, and parts of Tallahassee in the U.S. House. It's a strangely drawn congressional district that Alvin Brown, it seems, would like to take over. So can Alvin Brown make it a race and make it to Congress? Would you like to see Alvin Brown represent this city in Congress? Give us a call, 549-2937. And it appears, AG, as you've reported, Alvin Brown raising money and Corrine Brown, who will be sentenced soon following upon her conviction for the slush fund that her operatives were running, One Door for Education. Corrine Brown, your reporting, has been taking Alvin Brown around in Washington and introducing him to key players with the Congressional Black Caucus and so forth. It seems as though Corrine Brown would like to see Alvin Brown succeed her.
Yeah, and I don't know if Corrine's going to be useful beyond that level, but basically Al Lawson doesn't have a real buy-in with the Congressional Black Caucus. Alvin Brown does historically. Worked for Jim Clyburn in South Carolina early in his career. He's very comfortable with the CBC and their priorities. And so that means D.C. money could come in helping Alvin Brown out. That's a big deal because Lawson's fundraising right now, he's got $97,000 on hand, which is, you know, kind of sketchy for an incumbent midway through his term. It's not a lot of money, so Lawson is vulnerable. Here's the issue there for Alvin Brown. Audrey Gibson's been linked to this race. I asked her, are you any thoughts on Alvin Brown? She didn't respond. LJ Holloway ran last time, took some Corrine Brown's vote in Duval and other places. So if you get more than one Duval candidate in this race, Lawson walks to re-election. So it's in Lawson's interest to make sure that it's not just him and Alvin Brown going at it. If I were Al Lawson, I would have somebody do a back channel call to LJ Holloway, say, hey, we need your voice in this race, et cetera, et cetera. Get into this. Just butter her up a little bit, get her into this race, sort of split that Duval vote, confuse people. And, you know, that's Lawson's road. So Brown's got to get his campaign architecture going. He's already talking to consultants. He's going to be talking to media soon. So we'll see how it goes. But Brown's got to hit the ground running before another Duval candidate gets in.
Well, the numbers don't lie. Alvin is going to, if he runs, he'll have a tough road because Al Lawson owns Tallahassee and is not going to lose one single vote over there almost. And he would have to make a significant dent in Tallahassee in order to be successful here. And on the flip side, you know, Al Lawson has to do enough work here in Jacksonville, which he's trying to become accustomed to. He lives in Tallahassee, so it's very tough to, you know, to serve these two markets. It would be it would be incumbent upon him to chip off enough of Duval County to make the difference. And so you see the two working, but there's going to be no votes in Tallahassee for Alvin Brown.
And the other thing is, Alvin Brown does not own Jacksonville.
Yeah,
there's a lot of disenchantment with his term as mayor here, and people remember that. And you know,
there would have to be some fence mending done, is what I hear you saying.
I don't know. Yes, fence mending for sure, but also, you know, when you have a reputation of 4 years of mayor of really having not the no major accomplishments and no you know, no track record to speak of, you know, I mean, that's
speak to directly to the constituency he would be serving in the congressional district. So he'd have to prove the point that as mayor, this is what's better for you in Jacksonville, and I can do the same thing in D.C.
Still, mm-hmm. though, you reported, A.G., that Brown's PAC is bringing in pretty good money.
Well, this is actually 2015 mayoral race.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, that was from before. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, but it shows that he's got the fundraising ability. He actually outraised Lenny Curry in that race. I want to look at the figures real quick. But, you know, in the race in 2015, his political committee brought in $2.85 million, $750,000 in hard money, and also $1.37 million in in-kind contributions, mostly Florida Democratic Party, you know, consultants and the like. So, you know, Alvin Brown has proven he can raise the money before, and, you know, he may be able to do it again. It's just with that mayoral campaign, he had resources coming from all over the country. Al Lawson's fundraising so far has been from political committees, like labor committees and such. You know, Lawson hasn't really made the sale with the donor class in the Jacksonville area. So, you know, if Brown can mend the fences, if somebody like, you know, somebody can basically be his intermediary, you know, he can have a political rejuvenation. It's not impossible. I mean, Al Lawson is 70 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, he's mm-hmm. not able to do what Corrine Brown was able to do. And these districts that have like 2-3 major metros in them, you know, go from place to place and be there 27-6. You know, Lawson's more 8-5 Monday through Friday. And you know, so we're not talking about, you know, a great political machine being toppled here. We're talking about a first term guy who most of his district he hasn't represented before.
And let's talk about the fact that because of the way the districts were redrawn, it's a funky, weirdly shaped district. Well, whoever has
I thought they fixed
it's better than last one.
Yeah, I mean, whoever wins this seat is going to be in the weird position of having one foot in Jacksonville and one foot in Tallahassee. Yeah,
it may be fixed geographically, but it was easier to serve the district in its old conformity. I mean, from Jacksonville to Daytona to Orlando was much easier to service than it is now, with between all of the space between.
All right, and let's just go to a few calls, guys.
All right.
The call.
Tom in Fort Caroline. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Hi. Going back to the potential Rick Scott going for the Senate seat, I would never support him on his corporatist agenda. He's completely sold out, doesn't represent the people. He's in the pocket of Big Sugar. Our waterways are in a shambles. He's in the pocket of Big Pharma, middle of the opioid crisis. And he's doing nothing to promote the will of the people and get the medical marijuana done.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Jeremy in St. John's. Go ahead. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm really disappointed, Melissa, to hear about the numbers there with Bill Nelson. I strongly support him. And I'm kind of curious with your panel there. I've read a lot about, you know, the influx of Puerto Ricans having fled from the island coming here to Florida, and, you know, Nelson went down there on his own dime to see what the damage and try to come back to Washington to really help them. So I'm kind of curious if that might swing a lot more voters in his way.
Yeah, you know, we didn't talk about that, but we do need to make mention of that because that is something that political operatives have discussed, the fact that after Hurricane Irma, so many Puerto Ricans relocating, particularly to Central Florida in the wake of Irma, could shift some races just on the margins and just enough to tilt some races from red to blue. And whether or not that affects, say, a Rick Scott-Bill Nelson matchup remains to be seen. Whether or not that affects the balance of power in the state Senate remains to be seen. However, some political strategists like, say, Rick Wilson, a very vocal guy who talks about these issues a lot, those predictions have been made as of late. We'll have to see if they hold true, but that is something that is being watched. Yeah, because as you said, Charles, Florida is a red state unless it isn't. Yeah. It's right on that razor's edge. And a demographic tweak like 100,000 new Puerto Ricans along the I-4 corridor could affect some of these races one way or the other.
Well, the governor was savvy enough early on to say, we'll provide the support that you need in order to help the situation in Puerto Rico. So that was a savvy move.
And which campaign can capture those voters?
Yes.
Certainly, if Nelson's campaign is savvy, they're going to try to tie Rick Scott to Donald Trump as closely as possible in the minds of those Puerto Rican voters.
I'm sure that's coming.
But that's not going to hurt statewide. Actually, it's going to help him.
Right. Exactly right. All right. Well, we want to take a moment to remember the late Dr. Arnett Girardo of Jacksonville. He has passed away at the age of 88. Girardo led civil rights efforts in the Florida legislature. After serving in the military, Dr. Girardo received a dental degree from Howard University in Washington and then returned to Florida. In 1976, he was elected to the Florida House, serving until elected to the state Senate in 1982. He became one of the first African Americans to serve in the state Senate since Reconstruction. He was a founding member and chair of the Florida Conference of Black State Legislators, led civil rights movements in this community, held many important posts, and among other things, was a dentist to many people in this community. Rest in peace to him. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida do drunk tourists attack zombie bike riders. This happened in Key West during the annual zombie bike ride, because of course that's what they do in Key West. Australian tourist Prue Harvey was arrested on felony battery charges after she attacked 68-year-old cyclist Linda Malcolm and pushed her down.
Do zombies have right-of-way?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'll have to ask the Conk Republic. Harvey was drunk and told police she just had no memory of the incident.
Of course not.
However, family members of the victim say just before it all happened, Harvey was between bicycles, giving riders dirty looks and yelling out epithets. Malcolm suffered a few scrapes on her knee, but was not seriously injured.
So Malcolm was in the middle.
And how about this one? Only in Florida do visiting tourists slap police horses on the behind. In what might have been an ode to Mongo from Blazing Saddles, authorities say 20-year-old Casey Waldner of San Diego walked up behind an Orlando police mounted officer and slapped the rear of his horse, Izzy. Not a good idea.
Florida needs to bring in do better targeting with these people. Getting these people coming in, they're just slapping horses, knocking bicycles off the
road. These outside agitators are coming in and not sensitive to our local ways. No. Izzy spun around and Walder hoofed it when the officer tried to speak to him. The officer notified another mounted cop who was nearby and witnessed the slap. Waldner was arrested without incident, but was saddled with charges of attacking a police horse, resistance without violence, and, cocaine possession, too.
Yeah, she's had made all charges.
Wrong end of the horse, by the way.
Thank you, A.G. Gankarski, Charles Griggs, and John Berg. Guys, so good to see you. Have a great weekend.
Same here.
Go Gators.
Thank you. Go Gators. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Did you know even U.S. senators listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? Here's Montana Senator John Tester.
How I got turned on to this program, as a matter of fact, was riding the tractor. We don't get a really good NPR signal where I'm at, but on the tractor I get a decent one, and if I'm heading a certain direction, I can pick you up.
You know that? Really? Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. The thing you can listen to when you can't pick up any other station. Saturday and Sunday mornings on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Welcome back. Well, they grew up here in Jacksonville as the best of friends. Then Zach Clark and Nick Eliopoulos moved to New York City to start their careers as writers. Now they've come full circle, returning home here to the First Coast to launch their new book. It's the first in a young adult fantasy series full of magic, monsters, and mystery. You can come out to hear Zach and Nick speak and do a reading from the first book in the series at a special event this weekend. Buzz is strong on this. Kirkus Reviews calls the new book, The Adventurers Guild, quote, a page-turner with the perfect mix of suspense, humor, and engaging characters. Co-author Zach Clark is here now with a look inside the pages of The Adventurers Guild. Good morning, Zach.
Hi, good morning.
Good to see you.
You too.
So you grew up in Jacksonville, your best friend as well. You both went to the University of Florida, studied English.
Yes.
Then you made your way to the Big Apple, right?
Yeah. We're Florida boys, but New York is kind of the city it's a publishing capital of the country. So that's where we ended up. We knew we wanted to work in publishing, wanted to write, wanted to edit.
Right. And then decided to collaborate on young adult. Why that genre?
Yeah, Nick and I we're big nerds. We're big fantasy nerds. We love this game called Dungeons & Dragons, which people might remember from the 70s.
Sure, of course.
It's still alive and well. And this book kind of began as an exercise in role-playing, in the same way you do in that game. We each picked a character, we invented a world, and then we told the story through their eyes.
Well, getting a positive review in Kirkus is not an easy task. So right off the bat with your first outing, you guys have done pretty well for yourselves. That's pretty exciting.
Thanks. We're very grateful. We're blown away by the review, yeah.
Well, tell me about the Adventurers Guild. What's it about?
So our elevator pitch is that this is it's a fantasy world like Lord of the Rings or Dungeons & Dragons. There's wizards and knights and monsters. Except in our story, the monsters have won. We've got sort of a post-apocalyptic spin. Hundreds of years ago, something went terribly wrong, and this world just became totally filled with monsters. And now no one ever leaves the safety of these very high-walled cities except for one guild, and that is the Adventurers Guild.
How do they leave? How are they able to leave?
They're the only people that are tasked with exploring the world outside. There's doors, there's ways in and out, but monsters can't come in the city, and most people are too afraid or just not trained to go out and handle these things.
But they're somehow able to.
Yeah, exactly. Our two main characters are kids that they don't really want to join the Adventurers Guild. They've got high hopes to join these other sort of high, very important guilds. But through a sort of tragic twist, both of them end up in the most dangerous guild in their city.
Why do you want to be inside the mind of a kid when you're writing? And what's the age group you're thinking of when you're writing this story?
The book is YA, but it's sort of a muddy middle ground. We go from like 8 to 12, maybe 10 to 14. We write for kids, the kids that we think we were. You know, we just loved these fantasy stories. We loved living in these worlds. And when we go and visit schools and talk to kids about the book, their excitement and enthusiasm is just so contagious. It's the most fun in the world.
Yeah. And it's funny, too, because it's sort of a tragedy when kids cross that threshold away from that place that we all remember when we lived in that world of fantasy and imagination.
Yes.
And when kids leave that world, it's kind of sad. And it's hard as an adult, I think, to write young adult because you have to consciously go back there.
Yeah.
As an author, how are you able to access that? How are you able to go back there? And I'm curious because I think that's why really successful authors like, say, J.K. Rowling or even Tolkien with Lord of the Rings, they're able to build an alternate world of fantasy and make it so magical and so believable, not just for kids, but for adult readers too. How do you construct a whole alternate world that is magical and believable? That's a lot harder than it seems.
Yeah, well, it helps that we are both big geeks and we immerse ourselves in these sorts of stories anyway. It's not so tough for us. We love Harry Potter. We love Dungeons and Dragons. And this world that we built is kind of built on the fantasy stories that people are familiar with. We wanted to work with tropes that might be familiar to fantasy fans and introduce them to kids who might not be, but also add our own twist. So it is a world that fantasy fans will know. There are elves here, there are wizards, there are knights, but we also wanted to give it a little bit of a spin that felt different and more dangerous.
So I guess the old saw about the geeks inheriting the earth is true. If you ever got teased about playing Dungeons and Dragons,
right.
I guess now you're kind of having the last laugh, aren't you, Zach?
We're pretty happy with the way things turned out, for sure.
All right. Well, and by the way, you and your best friend did not go to the same high school. Is
no,
that right?
No. Nick went to Stanton and I went to Douglas Anderson. Yeah.
But you stayed friends.
Yeah. We actually met at UF. We had these sort of parallel lives here in Jacksonville. Never really met until college years and then realized, oh my gosh, we're both huge geeks and we're instant friends.
How funny.
Yeah.
Well, would you be willing to read a little bit from the Adventurer's Guild?
Yeah. Yeah. I could certainly do that. Let's see. I think I'll do a moment where Zed, who's my viewpoint character, discovers that he is actually going to be joining the Adventurers Guild. Zed is a mage. He's got sort of a knack for magic. And he really wants to join the mages. There's a guild here that is all wizards, all people who use magic. And Zed has sort of in this, there's a moment here called the guild culling where all 12-year-olds get assigned to a guild. And Zed finds out he's going to join the mages, but that sort of gets plucked out from under him. Sorry.
Sorry, I know I just put you on the spot there. You'll find the perfect passage here.
Yeah, there we go. Alabazal Frond cleared her throat, surveying the crowd with flinty eyes. Zed dropped his gaze as she passed over him. "We'll take two this year," the guildmistress said in a gravelly alto. "Dwarf son Jet Thunderhammer and Liza Guerra, the noble brat's sister." Then she spat right on the stage. Zed and Brock both turned to look at Jet, whose face had paled in horror. The other dwarves around him grumbled in solidarity, but none protested. "Anyone else want to volunteer?" she asked. "The remaining participants?" The crowd hummed softly as it turned its attention away from Frond, speculating at the guild's strange selections. Zed watched Jet as he returned to his place with the other dwarves. He'd never seen a dwarf cry, but for once he believed it might be possible. "In that case, I'll take the sorcerer too," Frond said. "The elf-blooded boy. I'm invoking the draft." And that's the moment where Zed realizes he's joining this guild.
Nice. So you are an editor at Scholastic.
Yes.
Do you live in Manhattan?
I do. I live in the East Village, yeah.
What was it like to go from Florida to Manhattan?
I still kind of complain about it a little bit.
Really?
It's a much more hectic pace. And I'll tell you what, the winters up there are pretty brutal.
You'd never been through a winter before? A real winter?
Not really. You know, my only snow was here. I think it snowed in Jacksonville once in 1989, and I remember it vividly. And that was kind of my first and only experience with it until New York.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you're co-author too. Same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
What's it like then after, how long have you been in the city now?
A decade. It's been 10 years now.
So after 10 years in New York, what's it like when you come back here looking at this place through the eyes now of a New Yorker?
It's much calmer here. It's much quieter, and it's so much greener. You know, I come here pretty frequently to visit my family. Nick is down here a lot. He has nephews who are in the Jacksonville school system. That's actually why he's not here right now. He's visiting his nephew's elementary school. And I think that for us, it is just such a pleasant break.
Yeah.
We're able to sit around with our parents, drive around, which is not something you can do easily in New York.
Yeah. I mean, don't New Yorkers at a certain point just say, I've got to get off the island. Like, I've just got to get off for a minute.
Those who stay there their entire lives, they need ways out of the city for sure.
Now, this is the first book in the series, correct?
Yes.
What's next? How many are planned in this series?
We've got 3 books signed up. We're going to tell a complete story there in those 3 books, but there's always the option to continue, and this is a world that we would love to explore as much as possible.
And writing with your best friend, you're still best friends?
Yes.
How's that going?
It's actually pretty great. Nick's...
That's working well?
Yeah, we started
no creative tensions?
Creative tension is actually kind of what is so beautiful about this project. We treat it like, you know, there's this idea when you're improvising that you can't say no to something. You have to say yes and. So Nick and I will throw each other these curveballs at the end of our chapters. There'll be a cliffhanger that the other person has to solve. And you can only say yes and. You can only keep moving forward. It's a challenge, but it's a pretty fun one.
Fantastic. Well, this is exciting because... You and Nick, the hometown boys, are doing a book signing tomorrow.
Tomorrow at Bookmark, yes.
Tell us what's going to be happening.
We'll be doing some readings. I'll have my readings a little better prepared. We'll be talking and answering questions, and we'll be talking a little bit about the process and about us and about our fantasy loves. It should be a blast. It starts at 6 tomorrow.
Should people come in costume, like a Harry Potter reading? It's almost Halloween.
Yeah,
I mean,
you know,
should they get into the spirit?
We'll try and find a way to celebrate that and give you a little treat or a prize.
Should people bring candy to this? I'm just trying to envision how this should be.
Yeah, for sure. It's Halloween. If you come in costume, we'll definitely find some way to call you up, celebrate you, and give you a prize or something.
Excellent. Well, bring your kids out tomorrow to the Bookmark. 5:00 is what my news release here says. The Bookmark, First Street, Neptune Beach, to hear
5:00,
a book signing and a public reading from the 2 local co-authors of The Adventurers Guild, the first in the young adult fantasy series, getting rave reviews. It's Nick Clark and his co-author, Zach Clark and his co-author, Nick Eliopoulos, will both be there to do the reading and sign copies of this new book. It's if you love Harry Potter, if your kids love any young adult fantasy books, come on out and check this out. It's going to be a lot of fun. Zach will not be in costume.
Not this time.
But maybe next time. And it's so good to meet you, and congrats on all the success. Thanks so much for being on the show. Will you sign that copy for me, maybe?
Yeah, for sure.
My 11-year-old, I think, would love to read it.
Oh, that's wonderful. I hope he enjoys it.
All right. It's a she.
She.
But yeah, thank you so much for being here, Zach, and kudos.
Thank you.
In a moment, your chance to do the time warp. We'll tell you about this screening of this weekend's Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's right after this.
I'm John Donvan. Coming up on 1A, the Democrats and the dossier. More details revealed about how the research on Trump's Russia ties came to light in the first place. Plus, the president bites back at his own party.
Even before the campaign, he came out with his horrible book. And I said, who is this guy?
We round up the week's news next time on 1A.
weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, how to teach your cat to come when you call, walk through a cat door, and stop bad behavior.
There has to be some reward at some point.
Sarah Ellis, feline behavior specialist and co-author of The Trainable Cat, says the rewards are food, play, or petting, and they have to be immediate. She'll also explain why you shouldn't punish your cat. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
You know that gene editor CRISPR? Well, it's now more precise and safer to use. I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we'll discuss the new tools added to the CRISPR tool chest for fighting genetic diseases. Plus, a tiny robot that can flap its wings in the air like an insect and swim like a jellyfish. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele. This week, a Prairie Home Companion will broadcast live from Pasadena, California, with our special guests. Dan Auerbach, Hillary Hahn will be there, Robert Finley, also Fiona Apple, and Nick Offerman. My goodness, what a show. Madison Cunningham is joining me for some duets. We'll have our band, The First Call Radio Players, a bit of comedy from the Acting Company, and a brand new Song of the Week. Hope you'll join us.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's your chance this weekend to do the time warp.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll. But listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control.
All right, just in time for Halloween, and with all new digital picture and sound, the cult classic The Rocky Horror Picture Show screens Saturday night at the Florida Theater. Host Carissa Wade is emceeing all the festivities, and she's here now with a ghoulish preview. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. This sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, it is absolutely awesome. It's always packed. It's totally interactive. You can throw everything, the water guns, the carts. Only thing you cannot bring is the food, because it's a historic theater, of course.
Can't throw food at the screen.
Right, absolutely.
And people need to know that you're kind of dealing with a little bit of a cold right now.
Yes, unfortunately, I do so many charity events at night that it keeps my throat stressed completely.
Yes. And I appreciate you coming in after a late night. Now, for people that have never been to Rocky Horror, the most popular cult film of all time, this is a thing. Like, when you go, there's a whole thing that goes along with it.
Absolutely. It's totally interactive.
Yeah.
You pick out different characters. There's so many things you say and do and yell out. So I highly suggest looking that up before you come. If you've never been, it's so energetic and so energized that you bounce off the walls from the excitement of it all.
It is. Yeah, it's so really much fun. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I went to see it, you know, and gosh, it's been so long now. When it first debuted, it wasn't even popular.
It bombed. It picked
up its cult following over many decades.
Right. Yeah. And as I was telling you earlier, the first time they ever booked me for that, it was a live production. I did Frankenfurter and had never seen the movie, never knew anything about the interactive. And they were throwing things at me and I was getting so mad. And then I got backstage, I was ready to fight somebody. And they're like, no, you're supposed to do that. I suggest you go home and watch the movie. And so I kind of did.
Now, what's your role going to be Saturday night?
This time I'm hosting and emceeing it. I bring on the band. We do the Sacrificial of the Virgins. We do the time warp. Then I end the movie as well. We do all the interactions. But if you're more interested in the live productions, 1904 is going to have a live production as well, with all the singing live characters, with like Blake Osner and stuff as well. So I suggest seeing that also.
This is a tradition all over the country. Before Halloween, people like to go out and see Rocky Horror Picture
right,
Show.
Absolutely.
And dress up.
Right. And this is my 6th year hosting it at Florida Theater. We always sell out. It's such a great thing. I highly suggest Ubering, though. It is Florida Georgia weekend. So getting in and out might be kind of a nightmare.
Very good tip, Carissa right. Wade. Now, let's also quickly mention that you want to talk about a few new fun things going on at Hamburger Mary's.
Right. We just opened up the Hamburger Mary's Pub on King Street. So it's a full show bar as well, but it's a sports theme. And of course, we have our other Hamburger Marys. And at that Hamburger Marys, we're doing a Halloween show. That's the 50 Shades of Grey Halloween party this Halloween. $100 for the best contest. It'd be a naughty, naughty bingo. So if you've never been there before.
Adults only.
Adults okay. only. Leave your children at home for that one. If you'd like to do a comedy bingo with us, though, you can catch us every Monday for our charity comedy bingo.
Excellent. And you, Carissa Wade, are a public figure in this community. You, for people who don't know about you, are Florida's queen of cabaret, comedy, and a community activist.
Right. I believe it's our part to do back for our community. The great thing is I'm in the spotlight, so I get to reach so many people who are in need and be able to help so many people hurting, especially right now in such a turmoil time in our country. We need to be able to laugh, to forget all of our troubles, and be able to help each other.
All right. So come on out Saturday and have some fun just in time for Halloween at the Florida Theater. It's the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Have a good time. And damn it, Janet.
Exactly. I love you. Now make sure you guys come say hello.
All right. Good to see you.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We always value your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything this morning, just catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Up next on 1A, the Friday News Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again Monday at 9 a.m. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.